Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. One of the things that some people found alarming this weekend was incoming Chief of Staff Reince Priebus on ABC This Week and how he answered this question from the host, Martha Raddatz.
Let's talk about another retired general, and that would be Mike Flynn, who he has chosen as national security advisor. He is highly admired for his work as an intelligence officer, but he has a history of controversial views about Islam. He said in an interview in July and at a conference in August that Islam is not a real religion, but a political ideology masked behind a religion. Is he in line with how President-elect Trump views Islam?
Well, I think so. I mean, look, phrasing can always be done differently, but clearly there are some aspects of that faith that are problematic, and we know them. We've seen it. But it certainly isn't a blanket for all people of that faith. But Mike Flynn is one of the most highly respected intelligence officers in America. Certainly no one can deny that.
Reince Priebus on ABC This Week, not just labeling ISIS or Al-Qaeda as fringe group, but saying there are some aspects of that faith that are problematic. With me now is Eliana Johnson, newly hired at Politico to cover the Trump administration. She has been working in conservative media as Washington editor of National Review, and before that as a producer at Fox News. We'll get her take on the transition. Eliana, thanks so much for coming on, and welcome to WNYC.
Great to be with you.
Does an answer like Priebus gave there, that aspects of Islam itself are problematic, and the appointment of General Flynn, do they signal a different approach to the war on terror than the Bush administration or other conservatives have had before?
I don't think they signal a different approach. I think they probably are more similar to those of the Bush administration than to that of the Obama administration. But I do think what is significant is that Trump promised something different from both. Trump suggested that he wanted to pound the heck out of ISIS at some points, but generally retreat from the world stage, even more so than President Obama had. He was tremendously critical of the Iraq war and said that many of our allies, including NATO allies, had been taking advantage of the United States. I would say that some of these appointments, though, are far more consistent with Bush administration foreign policy and differ from Mr. Trump on President-elect Trump on many things, including the war on terror. And I do think it's important to note, I think that they're similar to him in some of the inarticulate ways they talk about, for example, the war on terror. And Reince Priebus obviously going out of his way to correct that, saying it's not Islam, but a strain of Islam. And I would refer people to Mike Flynn, the incoming National Security Advisor's book, where he does say it's radical Islamist as opposed to Islam. So I think he hasn't been tremendously articulate in his public speeches, but in his writing, I think he does make clear that it's one strand of Islam rather than the religion as a whole.
How does that kind of language help to defeat ISIS if they're not putting it clearly in the way that you just laid it out? When Trump and Flynn themselves say we need Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Egypt and other predominantly Muslim countries to be more active participants in fighting ISIS on the ground.
Well, I think what conservatives and Republicans have been critical of the Obama administration about is an unwillingness to define the enemy and to say, yes, this is a part of Islam at all. And I think it's harmful to say it is Islam. That makes people very nervous. And it's incorrect to say that it's, you know, it's the religion as a whole. But Republicans, conservatives have really wanted people in the foreign policy establishment to say, yes, it is a strand of Islam. And these are the people that we need to go after to define them.
So now they've got that. What do they think the difference would be on the ground in actual effectiveness at defeating ISIS between President Obama calling them ISIS or ISIL, as he says it, and Trump or Flynn or anybody else standing up there and saying radical Islamic terrorism? How does it affect change?
I think we're going to have to see what sort of action the incoming Trump administration takes on the ground. Do they get involved in Syria, for example? How do they contain Iran? It's unclear right now, I think, what a President Trump will do on the Iran deal. But those are both of those things. The crisis in Syria and the Iran deal are things that Republicans and Trump on the campaign trail have been tremendously critical of the Obama administration on.
Do you have a sense of how interventionist Flynn wants to be? Because we know that one of Trump's talking points during the campaign was to denounce the Bush administration for, you know, excessive involvement in affairs overseas through the Iraq War. And that's part of his America First policy, as people understand it, more of a reluctance to use the military. And yet he talks about destroying ISIS quickly and things like that, which sounds like he would be interventionist. Is it at all clear to you where they're setting up to head?
It isn't clear to me precisely now how Flynn, in his book, which I think is the clearest guide to his thinking on this stuff, he does say that the entirety of American national power, military power, economic power, the nation's intelligence community has to be deployed to deny safe havens, shelter, and so on to radical Islamists. But that it's not clear to me precisely what that means on the ground across the globe, or how that would necessarily gel with Trump's own thinking on these things. And I have to say, I don't think Trump himself has thought this out in great detail, which is why his advisors, I think, will be particularly important.
They're talking about a possible registry of people from terrorism-prone countries. They're trying not to say Muslim registry anymore, but people from certain countries, which would be selected predominantly Muslim ones, plus North Korea, as I understand it. Are you familiar with what's in the works, if anything?
Yeah, I think it's something akin to something that the Bush administration did post 9/11 to try to increase sort of security. And I believe that this registry, which was for people from countries with high incidences of terrorist incidents between 2002 and I believe it went through to 2011, continued into the Obama administration. My understanding is that the incoming Trump administration is considering reinstating that. It was disabled under the Obama administration. It is not a registry of Muslims, but of anybody coming from those countries. There are many Christians who come in to the United States from those countries. But yeah, from countries where there are the highest incidence of terror abroad.
Are you familiar enough with it to have a sense of whether it accomplished anything when it was in effect, or whether this is just a way of whipping up an us versus them fervor?
I'm not familiar with it enough. My understanding is that the Bush administration considered it a useful tool and the Obama administration did not. My guess would be if you asked national security experts, there would be a debate about how useful it was. But I don't know enough to render an opinion on it one way or the other.
Listeners, our phones are still open as we talk about the transition with Eliana Johnson from Politico, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You came from National Review just now to Politico. So how much was the kind of thing we were just talking about, like the registry and that language about Islam, a reason that National Review was such a never Trump publication? Or where does it fit into the bigger context of National Review's stance during the campaign?
I should say National Review opposed Trump in the primary and didn't take a position in the general election. It was noteworthy that National Review didn't endorse a candidate in the general election. I think the last time that happened was when they didn't endorse Richard Nixon in the Republican, rescinded an endorsement for Richard Nixon in the 70s. But I would say Trump's specific stance on, you know, his approach to Muslim immigration from majority Muslim countries was only part of it. It was really that National Review saw him in the primaries, he wasn't the most conservative candidate on offer and endorsed Ted Cruz in the primaries. So I think it was really that he represented a more populist wing of the party. He wasn't a conservative. And National Review historically has endorsed the most conservative candidate, the most conservative viable candidate.
Is anything left of the never Trump wing of the Republican Party, as far as you could tell? Or was it only Republican intellectuals like in the media to begin with?
I think you'll see the never Trump wing of the party more or less disappear. I think the view of most conservatives now, who really made up the never Trump movement, is that populists control the presidency. The populist wing of the Republican Party controls the presidency. And more or less, the conservatives control the Congress. And so they'll praise the Republican Party when they do something good, and they'll call President Trump to account when they think he's doing something objectionable. That's sort of been the approach of the conservative movement going back to its founding in 1955.
What do you make of never Trump Republican Mitt Romney being considered for and considering accepting Secretary of State?
Yeah, you know, it's difficult to know how real I think the president-elect's overtures are to some of his most ardent critics during the campaign, Mitt Romney certainly among them. But I think if he is serious about it, I think it's a good sign, because I think that reaching out to critics and letting go of this sort of vituperative nature of much of the way that Trump campaigned is a good thing, not only for him and the way he would govern, but in general for party unity and for pitching a wide tent.
Let's take some phone calls. Melanie in Fort Greene, you're on WNYC. Hi, Melanie.
Hi. I have a question about this whole thing equating ISIS and al-Qaeda with Islam. What is the difference between doing that and equating the Klan with Christianity? I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Well, the Klan was more associated with whiteness, right? So I guess there were some Christian strands in Klan rhetoric. But Melanie, wouldn't it, if you're still there, be more accurate to say the Klan and whiteness, if you're trying to draw a parallel?
Okay, yeah, the Klan and whiteness with Christianity. Okay. They put crosses on people's lawns.
Yes, they certainly did that. The Klan, it's too much to say the Klan is back, probably, but there is, as you know, Eliana, a Klan chapter in North Carolina that's planning a victory rally in December because Trump was elected. There was an article today, I think it was in the New York Times, about an alt-right gathering in Washington of about 200 people, led by Richard Spencer, which by the end of which they were literally doing the Heil salute, and, you know, it was, really seemed neo-Nazi. So to her question on the analogy, or to how much you think the real radical, I think white more than Christian, hate fringe is being empowered now, what do you see?
Well, to the question, I think the reason that it's wrong to equate Islam and ISIS or, you know, whiteness with the Klan is that it casts far too broad a brush. And I do think words and vocabulary are important. And as to the question of whether this small fringe is being empowered, they may claim victory. As to whether or what they're achieving, I'm not sure they've achieved that much. I don't know what their declaring victory really says. I think they perceive they've achieved something. I'm not sure what they've actually achieved. But I think to equate them with Trump and his administration, I do think casts a bit too broad a brush. And I think the alt-right is something that it's useful to distinguish from the Klan itself. I would say the alt-right is a white nationalist ideology that seeks to displace traditional conservatism and to take over the Republican Party. I don't think they've succeeded in that. I think they perceive that they have an ally in President Trump. I'm not sure that's true, but they certainly haven't captured the Congress or the Republican Party as a whole.
Sharon and Teaneck, you're on WNYC. Hello, Sharon.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Eliana, I wanted to correct you. You said that there are terrorist-prone strands of Islam and strains of Islam. I would caution you to use instead that those sorts of ideologies are perversions of Islam. They are not part of Islam. And I would really caution you to not become part of the problem that we're seeing erupt. And I would add that I'm Jewish. I'm not Islam. But we all have to be really, really careful because hate is just becoming just a huge problem across the whole country. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything you want to say about that?
Sure. I think there's debate. These people who espouse extremists who espouse their religion claim themselves that they are espousing a part of the religion. And so I think it's open to debate whether they are perverting the religion or whether it is the true form of the religion. And I do think this war is taking place within Islam, and it is not yet resolved, of extremist Muslims and moderate Muslims. And so, I think I'm happy to have a debate about what the best vocabulary is to use. But I do think that this is an intra-Islamic and an intra-Muslim debate, and that I guess my view is it's not the place of non-Muslims or Americans to say that one is Islam and one is not Islam.
Well, I see it as a legitimate question that the listener is asking, because we as journalists have to sort of not take a side in this, but to characterize what's out there. And so if the debate within Islam is whether or not the ISIS type of ideology is a part of the religion or is un-Islamic but claiming to be a part of the religion, I think that's an interesting – I mean, that's an important distinction. I know we could take calls all day, as we have on many previous occasions, from Muslims who just say, this is not Islam. They are not Islam. I don't agree with that strain of Islam. Anyway,
right.
Go ahead.
I think that's a legitimate point of debate, and that is a debate and a war playing out within the religion right now, all over the Middle East.
Ibrahim in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ibrahim.
Hi, good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Good morning, Senator. Yeah, I must say thank you very much this morning for taking my call. And thank you, Senator, for standing up.
Well, Senator Gillibrand is gone, but I'll pass along your thanks. But our guest currently is a reporter, Eliana Johnson from Politico. But, Ibrahim, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. This morning, matter of fact, I'm a taxi driver driving New York City taxi yellow cab. And I had a guy in the West Village. He's trying to go to the Bronx. And he was standing in the corner on West 4. And he came to me that, can I go to Bronx? He said, okay, fine. Where are you going? He told me that I'm leaving the Bronx too. And he jumped in the car. He started crying. And I saw the face was bruising. I said, what happened to you? He said, well, he got beat up. I said, who beat you? He said, some certain white guys. This and that. I said, what happened? Why didn't you call for them? This guy was crying. I'm so sad. And I drive him there. I said, do you have money? And even though he lied to me that I think he want to get home. He said, okay, I have money. So we drive all the way to Bronx. He have nothing. And I called the police, not only for my money, but the way the situation. I called the police for him. They took him to the hospital. He's been begging me that, okay, I'm going to pay you, call me that. He gave me a number, everything, fine. I said, good luck. So the police took him to the hospital. That was so sad.
So you're saying this is a Muslim guy who told you a story about being beaten up because people assumed his faith?
He is Mexican.
Mexican.
Yeah, he's a Mexican guy. But the comment that I wanted to bring in the Muslims, one thing I know, everybody was saying that this what ISIL are doing, I don't think it has nothing to do with Islam. They have their own type of ideology. In the Islam, there is no teaching of Islam to kill anybody. Anybody.
So instead of Islamic terrorism, maybe you'd like to see them call it un-Islamic terrorism.
Yeah, exactly. This is different. You can think about it. 1.6 billion people, Islam, Muslims. How many percent are doing this? I don't know. It's a big question that I can't find an answer myself. Because nothing. They are creating all hatred for the Islamic box in general. But it has nothing to do with Islam. People have to understand that. I know it's not easy, but that's the way I look at it. One thing, one person can destroy the whole world.
Yes.
But you have to remember, not the whole Muslim and the world are supporting the 99.9% of Muslims. We're not supporting all these ideas. So please, let's wake up and voice out and call to solve this, because these guys, I don't think they have an aim of stopping anything until they take wild action against them, maybe before we have a peace. Otherwise, the ISIS, forget
yes.
about it.
And then, Ibrahim, Muslims
all over the world, Africa, Asia, everywhere. If you look at this, this is happening Middle East, even though we have Boko Haram.
What do you want to say, by the way? Do you have an opinion whether strong military action is the best way to defeat that 1%, as you say, if that's the right percentage, or something else?
Yes, strong military action, and then we need all these, like the way somebody come as there was, I heard somebody was saying that we need Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
We need some of these Muslims in the Middle East so they can help the United States to fight,
right.
Not even to fight them real hard to finish them once and for all.
Ibrahim, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for your call. As we continue with Eliana Johnson, reporter for Politico. Eliana, I'm going to turn the page a little bit and ask about what we just heard before you came on from Senator Gillibrand, which Senator Schumer was saying on TV this weekend, too, about Trump having run on some Democratic policies, as Schumer was putting it, like on infrastructure and trade and a paid maternity leave bill. The Washington Post and New York Times have both had articles in recent days asking basically if Trump is an independent and not really a Republican. How do you see this administration's early days shaping up in traditional liberal and conservative terms on domestic policy?
I think that's really a fascinating question. And, you know, I think Trump's seizure, I think the Washington Post called it a hostile takeover of the Republican Party, and that's exactly right. I think conservatives long believed that they comprised a majority of the Republican Party, and they don't, and Trump was able to reveal that in a way that was disturbing to many conservatives. But I do see, on a domestic front, there are many things with that I think he could strike compromises with Democrats on. What he's proposing really to do when he's initially inaugurated, Steve Bannon, his top advisor, said this publicly, is essentially an enormous stimulus bill, which ironically was one of the first things President Obama did when he got into office. I think that's something Democrats would be happy about, but it is something that conservatives will oppose. I don't think they'll be happy with. I think there's a chance Republicans will go along with it because they won't want to. They won't want to have disunity in the early days of Trump presidency. And on trade as well, you know, Trump's view that we may have free trade, but we don't have fair trade, and that workers are getting ripped off. That's a traditionally liberal democratic view. It's certainly the view of unions. And free market conservatives have long believed in free trade. I think the country's major trade deals have come when we've had Democratic presidents. Bill Clinton is the last one who have struck deals with majority Republican Congresses. And so I think TPP, the Pacific trade deal that the president has spent the last several years working towards, is unlikely to be passed when Trump is inaugurated. So I do think that Trump is most like the populist independents that we've seen run, like Pat Buchanan, Ralph Nader, these are consistent strains in the American political tradition. It's just that he is the first one to take over a major party as opposed to running like an independent. And we're likely to see policies passed, some that Democrats like and some that Republicans like, in the strain of a true independent.
You probably saw President Obama was out supporting TPP again yesterday and arguing that if we don't engage these 12 nations in a Pacific trade deal, which doesn't include China, China's already announced an alternative for them that has worse labor protections, worse environmental protections, worse intellectual property standards, and worse access for American exports into all those markets. What are conservatives in Congress, as your reporting would indicate, saying about those things right now? Is with President Trump being elected, is conservative support for TPP evaporating?
Well, I think you have to distinguish between conservative and Republican. I think we saw a sea change in 2016 in which many, many Republican congressmen and many, many Republican voters became opposed to free trade. And those were the voters Trump won. So members of the Tea Party movement and the Freedom Caucus and, you know, the furthest right Republican caucus in the House of Representatives, I think are unlikely to support the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the way Obama talked about it in Lima, Peru yesterday was almost in a bittersweet way. At the same time, it was the left wing in Congress that initially scuttled the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And so I do think potentially that there is an alliance of the far left, the sort of Bernie Sanders supporters, and the far right, Republicans and Trump supporters, who are likely to scuttle this deal. And it's centrist Democrats and conservative Republicans who would support it. So I think we've seen the traditional political coalitions on trade completely exploded, and there will certainly be a realignment on this issue that I don't think has really formed yet.
Trump supporter Eric in Tarrytown. You're on WNYC. Eric, thanks for calling.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Brian, I got a question for you, and maybe you can help answer it for me. Is there something inherently wrong with the idea of American exceptionalism, putting America's first, putting our interests first? There's a lot of talk about Trump that he wants to renegotiate trade deals. He wants to make our NATO allies pay their fair share. Is there something wrong with that? I put it to you, sir.
There's America First, which is a phrase. American exceptionalism is a really complicated context. I think every president from any party who was ever elected would say his job is to put America first, definitely. And on those things that you mentioned, those particular things that you mentioned, I actually don't think there's a whole lot of disagreement, Eliana. I think that when people get afraid and inflamed because of what Donald Trump says, it's not because he says he's putting America first, not because he talks about trade deals in America's interest as opposed to other countries' interest. It's that stuff that seems to go with it, empowering the so-called alt-right and the radical fringes of it through empowering Steve Bannon and the associations that he's had before, General Flynn, who talks about Muslims as a threat, not just the ISIS wing of Islam, if he wants to put it that way. So, Eric, those are the distinctions that I think people are making, as opposed to the terms America First or American exceptionalism or the particular policies that you named.
I would add just one thing. I think, the caller mentioned making our allies pay their fair share. And I think that's something that conservatives and liberals alike expressed some consternation at when Trump brought it up. I believe it was on the eve of his convention speech. The United States has shouldered the vast majority of the burden for things like the United Nations and for NATO, in particular because there was a belief that the United States is an exceptional nation and can afford to pay more and has the sort of role as a, you know, as a policeman and protector of, I think, smaller and more vulnerable countries around the world. So I think it tends to be the view of American exceptionalists that we don't view our alliances as sort of business transactions where we need to get every penny out of our allies, but we view them at times as protectorships going both ways.
Let me ask about one other thing before you go. I wonder if you've looked at the anti-Semitism piece of the debate about Steve Bannon. There seems to be a big divide right now between the Anti-Defamation League and the Zionist Organization of America. Are you familiar with what's going on there?
I am, yeah. What I would say is this: I don't believe that Steve Bannon is an anti-Semite. I think the debate between the two organizations is where do you draw the line on something like anti-Semitism. What I believe about Bannon and the Breitbart site is that they have sort of looked the other way and allowed intemperate language to flourish on that website. So I would draw the line between somebody's personal beliefs and associations and what, you know, sort of irresponsible language. I think one of the organizations has called attention to a headline calling the Weekly Standard editor Bill Kristol a renegade Jew that was written by another Jewish guy. Do I think that's great? No, I don't. Do I think it was irresponsible of the website to put it up there? Yes. Do I think the author of that piece is an anti-Semite? No, I happen to know him personally. But do I think those sorts of things should be out there? Do I think they're good for the discourse? No, I don't. And I think it is irresponsible of Bannon to look the other way. I think he's a very smart guy, and I think he knows he knows what these things do to the political discourse, which is inflame, stoke fear. And I think that's something he's done very successfully in terms of, you know, building up a group of support for a candidate like Trump.
Eliana Johnson from Politico, thank you so much for giving us so much time today. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks so much.